You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
Good Tuesday morning, Launch Streeters. Tamara here, your host and the winner of the how many pomegranate seeds can you put in your mouth while sitting backwards in a station wagon as a kid? Hey, it was the 80s. Don't judge. So are you like me and kind of fed up with all the talk about change management? It kind of drives me crazy because when you look at the stats, over 50% of change management efforts fail. Well, that's why I sought out a few of the leading change management experts because I wanted to better understand how to get it right so you could too. I mean, we all know that we have to deal with change on a daily basis. And so change management in some ways is necessary, but it feels like such lip service. So wouldn't it be nice if we could at least tackle it in the right way? Yeah, I think so too. Today's guest is going to help us do that. Paul Gibbons is the author of The Science of Successful Organizational Change. In fact, Paul thinks the opposite of what I just said in the intro. He thinks we don't talk about change management enough. We get into a good juicy conversation about this. I think you'll also get some insights around his thoughts on how availability bias is sabotaging my and your efforts and why questioning everything is so important. This is a lively interview, to say the least. Let's do it. Paul, it is such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with a little bit about you. What's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
When I was 15, I won a trip to the Bahamas in a disco dancing competition. And I used to wear size 27 waist, skin tight polyester pants like they did in the 1970s.
So please tell me that when we, you know, do all our social media posts that you will send me that picture so I can use that photo.
I'm just so horrible. Like, you know, the 1970s, like the chests and, you know, all those cheesy shows.
Yes. And the shirts are slightly unbuttoned.
Slightly down to like any, one button was like excessive for those days. Anyway, my nickname became Disco Paul. And I've never lived that down. There are like still people in the town that I went to college in, Madison, Wisconsin, that call me Disco Paul. I haven't lived that down. That's disgraceful, huh?
No, I don't know. I think that's brilliant. I'm not sure if it's disgraceful. I think to be able to own disco in that way is something you should never lose.
The problem is I'm 57. I'm too old to dance now. I mean, I'm too old. Like if I go to a club now, I'm that creepy guy. Harvey Weinstein. So that whole side of my life is I just have to close the closet. Closet, that's a good word. I have to close the closet on my disco side. And I actually still like EDM music, actually. That's a dirty secret. Yeah. I still listen to like Chainsmokers and DJ Khaled and all that kind of stuff. Anyway.
Well, if it makes you feel any better about like being too old to go to the club, I passed a club the other day on my way home. It was like 6:30, maybe 7 at night. And I thought to myself, wow, there's nobody here. This club is really dead. They're not doing very well. And then I realized, oh, yeah. I'm the only one who goes to bed at 8:30. This club doesn't even get bumping until I'm way asleep. Oh, yeah, I'm old.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's dig into change. So, because this is where your area of expertise and why I wanted to talk to you. Why do you think managing change is just such a hot topic right now? It seems to be, you know, on every magazine cover.
Is it really hotter than it's ever been? I don't know. I really don't know. Is it hotter now, it seems to you, than... It's always like a thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it ebbs and flows. I mean, it's always been around, but it's one of those things that has gotten a little more, I think, mass appeal these days. But also, I think because there's such conversation around, you know, the rate of change that's going on in the world we're in, that the managing it has just become a hotter topic across the board.
Yeah. It's funny. So every generation thinks that their generation is changing faster than everybody else. I'm not sure which generation is right. I said this in my book, like in the 1880s, there was electrification, the steam engine, the telephone, radio, hydroelectric power. I mean, good golly. So there have been lots of periods in our time, in the time around World War II, there were airplanes and motor cars. So we think it's called the availability bias, a cognitive bias. We think that we're so special that but anyway, be that as it may, the question isn't really whether there's too much talk about change. It's whether there's not enough. And I suppose, given that what managers do, what they've always done, is deal with change on a day-to-day, like most of their headaches are to do with change. It's a new employee, or it's a restructuring, or it's a new product line, or it's a new initiative for marketing, or there's some HR policy, or there's a new strategy for the chief executive, or there's a merger. So given that managers are drenched in change, do we spend enough time talking about change? It's not whether we like spend too much time talking about change. That's what I think.
I love your analogy, by the way, about the generations. I was just talking to my parents who are on the older side of baby boomers, and we were talking about change. And I swear my dad started with "in my day." And I was like, oh, gosh, that sounds like a lot of change. You're right. It feels like it to us because we're living it versus we are, you know, microwaves are in every kitchen now. That's not new.
Availability bias is an interesting thing. So it applies to work and it applies to morale and engagement at work. The availability bias means that we overweight the data that's available to us. So it's interesting, right? Now, we couldn't really do anything else, but it means in workplaces, like if you're at home, say you're married, right? You see the work that you do, the dishes that you do, the garbage that you take out, the reading stories to the kids. You see your work. So it's very easy because of the availability bias to see your partner's a lazy sack of shit, right? Because of the availability bias. But that happens at workplaces too, because we see only how much effort we're putting in, how much we're slaving away at midnight, and how much we're, you know, feeling stress, and that we are not conscious or aware of the fact that that may be everybody's journey as well. So anyway, that's the availability bias. Pretty cool thing.
Are you referring to the fact that none of the men in my house see the dog hair that I see, Paul? Is that what we're really talking about here?
No, you have special enhanced vision.
I want to go back, though, to what you said about we actually should be talking more about it. I think that's a little bit of a flip of, I think, some of the narrative out there right now. But when you think about that, what should we be talking about when it comes to this?
Well, if my hypothesis is right, is that managers are drenched in change, then the question you have to ask yourself is, where do they learn to manage it and deal with it? If you look at the Harvard Business School, they have 100 electives at the Harvard Business School. Do you know how many have to do with change?
No.
One. As an elective, one out of 100. And they're not part of the core curriculum. There's like seven or eight things you have to take. You know, you obviously have to take finance, you obviously have to take accounting, you have to take marketing, you have to take strategy. But actually, how to make change happen on the ground, whether it's the day-to-day change of onboarding an employee or restructuring your department to the sort of mega change of a merger, how to make that happen is just not taught. So
do you think that the disconnect for managers today then around change is knowing what to do or just having the bandwidth to implement it? Maybe this isn't an either or question.
Having the bandwidth to operate or knowing what to do. Well, let's see, I don't know how to answer that question. Say it in a different way.
Yeah. So the reason I'm asking is, you know, I'm thinking about a conversation I had recently with a client of ours who leads about 150 people. And one of the things he was saying is, you know, we're reorging, we're having these new changes, we're adding new revenue streams, we're blah, 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 blah. And then he said to me, that's on top of all the shit I have to get done every day.
Right, exactly.
So it was a part of me started to wonder, wow, does he not have the skills to manage change, and or does he not have the time?
Well, he probably doesn't have either. And certainly if you don't have the skills, then it's going to be harder than it ought to be.
That's
right?
Very true.
So,
yeah.
So it could be both and, right? I think that everybody's wrestling with that. I mean, one of the things that we sort of teach people is that there used to be, when I was in a big consulting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, we used to have the sort of business as usual and then the change. And I think teaching people in business schools or in consulting or wherever that there's a vision of business that's like static, where nothing ever changes. Where change is just like this once in a blue moon thing. It's just not like that. And so when you teach people that change is the exception and not the rule, organizations are flowing, dynamic, rather than static. When you teach them that, then when organized, then change will obviously, I think, be received less well. I mean, the world we live in today, maybe it's always been that way, is a dynamic and rapidly changing world. And so the lives we have to lead as human beings and as business executives are lives that where there's constant ebb and flow of change. So I think we just need to think about things that way and not treat, you know, when someone cuts you off in traffic.
Yeah.
You don't want to treat change that way. You don't want to say, you know, that custom. It's not like that, because that's the way life like always is.
I hope that LaunchTreaters out there listening are really thinking through what their mindset is around change and how they're leading quote unquote change. My question for you then, Paul, is if you were to advise them on how to think about change, what mindset should they have around it? How should they view it? Because I'm with you that it shouldn't be a point in time exercise. I think sometimes the flip is harder.
Well, I mean, the biggest mistake, I think you'll agree, right? The biggest mistake that people make, I've had to name one mistake of the many mistakes, right?
I mean, I made 10 today, so.
already yeah. Before breakfast, right?
That's right.
The biggest mistake people make is not involving people sufficiently or early enough in the decision-making process, the deciding how to change. So that could be strategy or it could be an operational change, but insufficient consultation or involvement or participation or engagement or whatever you want to call it. This is like social psychological research from the 1940s and 1950s is when you involve people in decisions that affect them, they are more welcoming to you know, play nice, to make nice with your decision. Surprise, surprise, right?
Yeah. I mean, what's that old phrase is, it's not that we fear change, we fear being changed, someone having it done to us.
Yeah, it was Peter Senge. Yeah, he's a clever boy. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So if I pick up your book, The Science of Successful Organizational Change, and we'll put a link in the show notes because it really is an incredible book, what will I take away from it?
Oh, my God. You know, one of the problems with the books, it probably should have been 6 books. I think one of the things that I'd like people to take away from it really broadly is question everything. So I was a change. I reinvented myself in 1995, let's say, because I'd been working on a lot of strategy projects. I was a strategy consultant, and we used to prepare for – I was working for mostly banks, mostly Wall Street-type banks at the time. We used to prepare long, long reports, really in-depth studies of how they should proceed strategically. And then we used to try and engage the organization, and – the reports ended up decorating shelves and bottom drawers and circular filing cabinets.
I've been there.
So I'm like, when are the people going to blow the whistle on us? I mean, this is BS that we charge people millions of dollars for this. And then we say later and leave the, you know, just the implementation to them. So I began to become really intrigued by this. And I also tell this story like about change. So I used to work back when I was a Disco Paul. I worked in a lab doing cancer research.
You're still Disco Paul to me. Don't worry.
Oh, that's awesome. I never let that sit down. But I used to work at cancer research, and this is back in the day, back in the 70s. I was going to go to medical school back then. And so I was working in cancer research. I was experimenting on little white mice, and this is gross, right? Forgive me, right? But I used to give them cancer, right? So I used to squirt the mice with a carcinogen from cigarette smoke.
Wow.
So, right. So anyway, so we knew in the 1970s, we actually knew in the 1950s that smoking caused cancer. It's amazing that they're still legal, but that's another book I'm writing. But here's the thing about change though, right? I used to go out in the parking lot after giving the mice cancer with this thing from cigarettes, this chemical from cigarettes, and smoke Marlboro, right? And I wanted to quit smoking desperately in the 1990s. So here I was. So it was up in my face. It's like, I'm finding this incredibly difficult, yet all the rationale. I used to do cancer research. You know, you think I'd have a leg up in the game, but in practical terms, I didn't. And it's the same with our strategy. So I became fascinated by change. So what's the first thing we learn in change school? Back at PricewaterhouseCoopers, there was a 2-week course that you took to learn about change management. Which is not nearly enough, but yeah. I think that's the sort of ante. So anyway, there's this 2-week course for consultants. So the first model we learn is from Kubler-Ross, who was a I think she was a social scientist or a psychologist in the 1960s who wrote a book called On Death and Dying. And she studied patients who were near death, you know, who were, you know, coming up to the final things. And they went through a cycle, which you've heard before: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that before?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. And we teach that to everybody, right? So that's like page one of the change book. This is what people go through, right?
Uh-huh.
So like her research, even on death and dying, was she had this model in her head and she interviewed people, and surprise, surprise, the interview data that she got from people accorded with her model. So that's the first thing. It's not like super good research. But the second thing, why does change in business have to be like death?
Excellent question.
What is that? So this metaphor, and I'll talk about one other really stupid metaphor in a minute, has been projected by the psychology people when we were the 60s and 70s. They've been projected by psychologists onto entire organizations and individuals. And if you don't have this response, guess what? You're in denial.
Right.
But is it not possible for people to engage for change with energized, up for it, excited, innovate, like this new thing? Like the narrative around change does not have to be associated with the narrative people have when they're about to leave the planet. So I just think that's a bullshit model. It's not really validated in psychology, even for dying people as well. And when we use a metaphor, people say, oh, okay, people accept these metaphors without really thinking about, well, is someone dying? Is that an apt? Or even if it's useful, is it useful for me to think about change in a way that's like a grief experience or a loss experience? So I think no, right?
Yeah. Yes. Let me ask you a question about that, because I'm a little bit like gape-jawed thinking about it, because I actually came up in my head was a presentation I went to where the person went through this model exactly of change and the denial and the fear and the grief and et cetera, et cetera. And if I hear you right, you know, if I'm listening to this, if I'm a launch leader out there and I'm leading a team, I'm a manager on a day-to-day basis, if I go in with that mindset of change is like dying –
yeah.
Or knowing I'm going to die, then that's what I'm going to get out of it.
Exactly.
And if Tamara, who works for me, doesn't fit that model because she happens to love change, well, then she's just in denial of what's to come. So you just validate your own crap.
You do indeed.
Yeah.
You do indeed. Yeah. I just think we're not really sufficiently – so my book is kind of a sort of a big, big debunking of a lot of what passes for wisdom on change. So the other one Cotter's 8 Steps, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, bless him, he's a Harvard professor, and his books, you know, it's a pretty good book, right? I mean, it's not my favorite book. It's not even in my top 20 books on change. But anyway, it's a pretty good book. So Peter Senge's Learning Fifth Discipline would be number one in my book, in my thing. But anyway, so his 8 Steps. So the first one is create a sense of urgency, right?
Yep.
So like he's a Harvard professor. You know, I'm sure he's a pretty clever guy and everything like that. Who says, is that the way? Like if you take Google or you take Cisco, or you take Amazon, are they running around saying, oh, we have to inject some urgency into this part of our business? Because in a well-run business, it's dynamic and it's flowing and it's everything is important. I mean, it's not like everything's always equally urgent, but is that really a useful thing that you have to do in order to launch change? And part of that, the metaphor that we used is burning platforms. So you've heard burning platform before.
Yeah.
My clients, your listeners have heard burning platform before. It's accepted wisdom. So the metaphor comes from, there was a North Sea platform that caught on fire. And one of the things, if you're going to work on an oil rig, they do is they train you, never get off the rig. Because if you go in water that's temperature of 36
or 40 degrees.
You're gonna lights out. So they train you that, but the only people that lived were people that jumped off the rig because the whole rig went up. Right. Okay. So anyway, that's one of those.
So again, the rule doesn't apply.
Right. So anyway, that's where the metaphor comes from, burning platforms, from an oil platform. It's kind of a macabre, you know, metaphor to start with. But anyway, so now you think about it, like, is that the way that you want to run your business? Do you want to run your business creating burning platforms where people are, you know, literally, you know, fighting for their life or gasping for air, or if you're lurching from burning platform to burning platform to burning platform for change, are you running your business like, excuse me, I'll be a little bold. I mean, are you running a business like a moron?
Yeah.
Are you being the guy who's being disrupted rather than doing the disrupting? And if you think about the well-run organizations today, are they lurching from burning platform to burning platform? No, they're the ones who are lighting the fire, if to use that stupid metaphor even further. So we use these metaphors unthinkingly and unreflectively. And I'm part of the problem because I've been a change guy like 25 years. So for a decade or so, or 15 years, I was the one that accepted most of this sort of dogma around change uncritically.
So I have two questions for you. So before I get into those, though, let me just quickly go on a tangent and ask you, when did you realize that, hey, you know what, this stuff isn't really accurate and we're using all these models or we're buying into these narratives that actually don't serve us?
Yeah, well, partly, you know, again, a little bit later than I would have liked earlier on than that. So one of the things when I ran a consulting firm, we used to do leadership consulting work, and I had a lot of very spiritual people. A lot of people in the change world and the coaching world are quite spiritually inclined. Is that right?
It's amazing how that comes together.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? The Boulder crew, the Northern California crew. So I had an organization full of them, and we ran a workshop for clients using an ancient spiritual structure called a labyrinth, which traces its history back to ancient Babylon and the ancient city of Ur. So we use this ancient structure. And if you walk around this ancient structure with a question in mind, then ancient wisdom will be revealed to you. Now, at the time, I was on my own journey, which is from being a sort of spiritual dude to a kind of really kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, anti-spiritual, whatever. And I was like, people are really doing this and they're really falling for this. Is what we're teaching clients. Now, okay, so that's a little far out there, but there was so much stuff. I've led drumming workshops. I've led Native American retreats for people. I've done ropes courses have their value, but I have done everything that's alternative in the 1990s that was possible to do. I have done, and I've done it with not Fortune 500 companies, like Fortune 50 or Fortune 20 companies. So the biggest companies of the world are spending millions and billions of dollars on stuff, some of which is a little bit funky. And I began to question it myself. And then I wrote this book, and there was a great book by a guy called Lilienfeld, which is called the, I don't remember what the name is, 50 Psychological Myths That Aren't True. And he's like a researcher, I think, at Emory University. And I thought, and I picked it up, and so many of the things that I had taken for granted as psychological wisdom are just disproved by research, right? They're just like, no, I'll tell you another one, learning styles.
Go on.
There's no such thing.
How so?
Well, so the way you would do learning style research is you would investigate someone's preferences and then you would give them material to learn. And if they were learning material in a way that they preferred, so they're, I don't know, what do you use for learning? VAK? Do you use visual, auditory, kinesthetic? Or which one of those things do you use? Or Kolb's learning styles, or style you use? One of those, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't use any of them on a daily basis, but I know of all of them.
Sure, right. So there's no relationship between the kind of learner that the psychometrics predict that they are and how quickly or how well they learn the material, right? Because psychologists study this stuff and they say, okay, well, we're going to study visual, auditory, kinesthetic learners. I learned that like day two of the change course. There were certain learning styles and you have to present information to people in a way that accords with their learning style. So as far as psychology is concerned, that's a pile of BS. Now, I would say that I've just offended 99% of organizational psychologists and change practitioners in the world because we teach that stuff all the time. And it's convenient knowledge too. Like when you don't want to learn something, say, oh, it's not been presented to my learners. So I'm a visual learner. I can, you know, and in a way, it's one of the ways that people can find defenses to learning is that it has to be presented in such and such a way because we have such and such a preference. And so just on a funny note, there was an article in the Onion magazine saying parents of nasal learners up in arms that schools are insufficiently – that are discriminating against their children that are nasal learners.
Perfect.
So anyway, all right. So it was pretty funny. So anyway, so I sort of wanted to, when I wrote the book, sort of have a wake-up call and then also start to put some stuff in there that did look – like there was a lot of evidence for it. And that did look like that was closer to sort of psychological reality. I mean, one of the things that there's so much evidence for is mindfulness meditation.
Yep.
And the effect on task performance, on well-being, on curing of mild psychological ailments, of attention, detail, focus. I mean, almost any outcome, psychological, individual outcome, mindfulness meditation seems to have a positive effect of it. And I'm not talking about do it for 10 years. I'm talking about do it for 2 weeks. Because they take in control groups, controlled studies, where they take
I think it was like 9 days, right? You could see a change.
Right. Yeah, like they got one group does yoga, one group does nothing, maybe journaling, one group does the mindfulness meditation. And then they compare outcomes from the various groups, and mindfulness meditation produces things. So there's a lot of evidence for that. And so it's not that everything that there's evidence for has to be dry and dusty and boring and BS, right? There are some things that are really useful that workplaces can be doing to equip their people to be effective in the world that we live in today.
So, you know, this kind of all goes back to your comment in the beginning about question everything, because I'm kind of hearing – there's two things that I'm hearing from you that I'd love to get your perspective on. One is – question what you're reading about why you're doing what you're doing. When someone tells you this is the way it needs to be done, or here's the model, why? And how does it apply to you or not apply to you, as opposed to just taking it at face value? But the second part, I think actually maybe this is the bigger part that I want to keep the discussion going on, is that the theme that I'm hearing from you is, look, we as humans are dynamic and our organizations are hence dynamic. It's a living organism in its own way. And for us to try to pigeonhole change in particular into one specific approach, style, model isn't quite the right way to do it, because we're so dynamic. We have to approach change in a more dynamic way. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't really found. There's a quote I use it in the book. I think it's from Tolstoy. Is happy families are all alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. that's Tolstoy, not me.
Yeah.
I think it's the beginning of Tale of Two. Maybe, no, I can't remember. Is it Tale of Two City? No, that's Dickens. I can't remember. Anyway, it's one of those very clever guys. So anyway, it's true. I think that every change project is distinct in its own way. So, you know, the hard work for us as people who are called upon to advise people is, people always want, what are the three things I need to do, or what are the 10 principles, or what are the two models I need to know, or something like that. And we want to give them some of that. I mean, you can't just say, you know, I make it up as I go along, and you inquire, you need someone of my 25 years experience and deep sensitivity to solve each change problem, because it's each change problem. We need to give them something.
Yeah, a framework.
Yeah, we do. We absolutely have to do that as well. But I'm always cautious about recipe book approaches to change. How many change models are there out there at the moment, would you say? I mean, you've talked to a lot of people, right? Tons. Yeah,
I mean, I don't know, but every person I've talked to has a different model, so.
It's right. And to any of them, I mean, there's already a model in today's world, you know, we've been at this for a long time, that's head and shoulders above any other model, that's like so much more effective and better at getting the job done. And I would be hard pressed to choose one, right?
I mean, I'd say that, no, I agree with you. I'd say that just thinking through even the recent interviews I've had, they are similar models with slightly different twists on them. I'm not sure any one of them could stand out to me as being so distinct that I thought, well, I've never thought about it that way.
You know, it's so funny though. We're consultants though, so everything that we do has to be distinctive and rebranded.
Yeah, no, they're all trademarked in some way.
Right.
And I do the same thing in innovation, by the way. So I am in no way throwing stones. I think it's just, I think to kind of to your point, right? There's a lot of different ways to look at it, but we've also been doing this a long time, and there are frameworks that we build off.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you need to start somewhere. We don't start with a blank slate, at least not as, you know, 35-year-old business people. We don't have a blank slate. So, yeah. So that's part of like what I tried to do in the book. And again, there's stuff in there that's not found its way into many books on change, which partly means when people read it, they think, why am I reading this crap? Yeah. So stuff on psychology of risk. So I think it's really important when you're an innovator or you're an entrepreneur or you're someone leading change in an organization, particularly if you're at the top, organizations are always about placing bets. Now, we don't think of it 100% that way, but anytime you start a business, you're placing a bet, and you ought not to persuade yourself that there's 100% chance, because unfortunately statistics will let you down. You know, you're a 3-to-1 underdog or a 2-to-1 underdog if you start a business, right?
Yeah.
Most of them fail. So anyway, so we should do it with our eyes open. But when we're taking risks, a new product launch or hiring a person, or even you take risks with your education, say you decide to become an engineer or something like that, you're taking risks that this education will. So we're taking these kind of risks all the time. Well, one of the things is that the psychology of risk, how human beings act in situations that are probabilistic, is just really, really moronic. So for example, after 9/11, people stopped flying.
Yeah.
Right? And they took to the roads. And so what happened? Deaths from travel
went up.
Road fatality. Yeah.
Yeah.
So people are trying to make themselves safer because why? So I have a very educated and lovely woman who's a friend of mine, and I had dinner with her, and I was like, you should take your husband to Europe for your 50th or 55th wedding anniversary or whatever it is. And she said, I won't go to Europe. There's too much terrorism. And God, she's a dear friend, but you've got more chance of being eaten by a shark.
Right, yeah, being in a terrorist attack. Yeah.
So, but because of the emotion that we attach to all of these things, or child abduction or terrorist attack or something like that, we behave irrationally. And so in organizations, there's a sort of, we're always taking risks. And I think understanding the way your team operate under uncertainty and under risk is something that I put in the book, but it's not like familiar territory. We don't change this and teach this in change management. I had an interview. I was interviewed this morning for Risk Magazine, which is a Wall Street publication on managing risk. And I was talking about risk culture. They don't even in investment banks really teach people about the psychology of risk and how human frailties and human biases and human limitations interact with the mathematics. Because that's the interesting bit, is where humans meet the math.
Let me ask you this about risk, because I find that part, the psychology of it, fascinating. And the culture that is created around risk in an organization, is that culture created because of all the – I'm not quite sure how to ask this, so bear with me as I stumble – but all the individuals and how they deal with risk, or is that really a top-down that gets trickled down? Can we – I guess what I'm trying to say is it our hard wiring that we bring to it, and or is it the culture that we come into and the risk psychology we adopt?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So we live in this fantasy that everything will succeed. So when I'm starting a business, I started a business in 2001, right? I didn't really entertain the probability that 3/4 of the time I would be bust within 18 months. We persuade ourselves of something different. I don't know whether that, you know, when I have started the business, maybe that kind of psychological delusion is helpful. I mean, maybe that denial, maybe it is. Maybe I wouldn't have started. So like 3/4 of the time, I'm going to lose $250,000. No, thank you.
Right. That's horrible math, actually.
So, but yet again, and I think this is one of the pieces of dogma that's really good at the moment, is we're encouraging organizations to have a constructive attitude towards failure. Because that will allow, you know, that will create a culture for innovation, right? Fail fast, fail forward.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think the two I'll just say with that, with the failure thing is, you know, the challenge that I think we see a lot with organizations is we love the idea of failure, but when it actually happens, we don't love it. So we you know, wrap it up in a pretty bow and we put it on the failure shelf and we deliberate about all the things that we learned and then we hope to God we never have to talk about it again. And it's kind of, I mean, it's really unfortunate because there's so many great lessons wrapped up in that pretty bow. I think the people in the organizations that tend to get it right recognize that whatever happened is really just a stepping stone to the next thing. And I'm not saying that we should, you know, everybody gets a 10. And, you know, this is not that kind of culture where you should never have failures or never use the word. I think it's just a matter of how you use it.
100%. You're talking about the inauthenticity. So we're... you know, this whole bullshit, our people are our most important asset, right?
You're the second person, by the way, to say that to me today. You're saying it in a very different way. The other person, I thought, are you sure about that?
Well, they still, the inauthenticity of saying, you know, with the sort of, we welcome failure, right? And then truth be told, you know, if someone does quote unquote fails, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Right. So that kind of inauthenticity, and that's just, God, you want to talk about toxic to morale. That's certainly one of them. But I think that's one of the pieces of dogma that actually it's both an embracing of reality, because in reality, if you're changing and innovating, you're going to fail. You know, Amazon's an amazing company. God, I made a ton of money on Amazon this year. But there's a whole list. I think I may have put it in the book about like 10 innovations they launched. They spent considerable amount of money on, which were complete flops. And we don't see that side, because then this is the availability bias, right?
Right.
We only see the Echo and CreateSpace and Kindle Direct Publishing and buying Whole Foods and, you know, all of the amazing things they're doing. They're woven into our world right now. We don't see the tens of thousands of things that they got wrong along the way.
Right.
That's the availability bias again working out. So that's like, I think there's something to learn from the psychology of risk, but there's something interesting. There's a bullshit, again, the way that we actually price innovation and risk in companies. So can you imagine that there's somebody that goes up and he's presenting to the board for this new project or a new product launch or a new innovation or something like that. Or maybe it's a Silicon Valley pitch or something like that. And he pitches and he says, 25% of the time, we'll make a lot of money in this. You know, the returns will be 200% of the time. But 2/3 of the time, we'll lose almost all of our capital. And 1/6 of the time, we're going to lose, you know, $2 million.
Yeah.
You know, can you imagine someone pitching something like that? But that's reality. But we discourage people from talking about reality, which is that, you know, I'm sorry, buddy, 2/3 of the time, it ain't going to work. But that guy wouldn't last very long in the boardroom if he produced this kind of probabilistic outcomes, because the outcomes from a project will be along the bell curve or something like the bell curve, right? So we teach people, we don't do that. He say, you know, our ROI on this project will be 17.23% and our hurdle rate is 12%. Therefore, we should do it.
Yeah.
I've gone on and on about this stuff.
No, it's just, I'm just thinking, you know, it's fascinating to me about when you think about, especially if change is constant, if you take it as not a point in time exercise in particular and something that you're just always dealing with, your math is always going to be like that. So, you know, or at least that's my assumption anyway, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it makes me wonder how many of us are really not denying change, but not managing it the way we should and can because of our psychology of fear around it, of what the possibilities are and how it could turn out.
You mean people who are anxious about embarking upon change because it could, like me and my business. Did I sort of talk myself into it by imagining that I was going to be the next McKinsey or the next Goldman Sachs, right? I mean, we delude ourselves, you know, maybe it's a comfortable delusion. As I said, maybe I wouldn't have started the business if I'd had a more realistic appraisal of my assets at the time. I mean, when I started the business, one of the things I believe in that's, again, part of change dogma that I think is 100% on target is the importance of vision. Because really, when I started my company, I had nothing but that. I had no assets. I had no clients. I didn't have much money saved up in the bank, all those things that you're supposed to do. I had no staff. I don't want to say I had no. All I had was I could do something. I could create a consultancy that could do something really special that nobody else out there can do. Everybody gets this wrong. We're going to get this right. That's all I had. And for like a year, people worked for me for free, because what the story I told was so compelling that I didn't really have to. People were working. Some of them had jobs. Some of them didn't. They were working. They would come to my living room and we would have these great conversations about creating this business. They wouldn't have to be paid because I'd created a compelling vision. And so that's one of the things, if I had to say, like most executives suck at that, right?
Yeah.
So have something that people, you know, I don't want to say would die for, because that's, again, it's another stupid metaphor, but, you know, that people just really feel as part of their DNA that they want to get up every morning to do. And if you could do that, if you could paint a picture of what you're trying to do as a business or what you're trying to do as a startup, if you could paint that in vivid emotional terms that touch the heart but are still rational, like still make sense, or something like that, you're a long ways towards getting a change project off the ground, don't you think?
I do. I mean, I think what you're saying really resonates, and it's around the, if you have someone at the helm, two things that I hear you saying. One is if you have someone at the helm with, and whether that's the helm of the company or the team or, you know, your small group, who has passion and vision, you can get other people excited about the change and maybe not do the whole denial, fear curve that we were talking about in the beginning, but yeah, get people really rallied and excited. But the other thing I hear that I think is equally as important is if you can get people on board for the why you're doing what you're doing, it's not about necessarily, oh, I'm buying into change because I love change, or I'm buying into the process. It's I get the rationale, I buy into the reasoning, and that why is so important for all of us to get up in the morning and keep doing what we're doing.
And there's something in it for me too. You know, one of the things I used to say is it's not the most persuasive argument in the moment to say that people should, you know, work hard for you because you're going to make them considerably richer at the end of the day. People want to find themselves in the vision. They want to find something in it, some expression of their purpose, some expression of their meaning in life, some expression of their what they're able to learn to forward their career. So when you're crafting this, it can't just be an egocentric, this is what's in it for me. The vision has to really be a we vision. And people are poor at doing that. I mean, yeah, one of the things that we'll do with the executives is I'll have them craft something like that over and over and over again. And I'll have them do the elevator pitch over and over and over again. And I'll sit there and go, that's boring, man. That is like boring. Like, really? Come on. We need to get inside and under people's skin with something here and really work on it and craft it. So that is the sort of thing that people get out of bed for, you know?
I love that for launch readers out there listening, I would really think about how you can bring other people into your vision, whether that's a small thing you're trying to do or a big thing you're trying to do. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think we go to the world with me, and more about me or my vision, mine. And we kind of forget that there's someone on the other side of the table who's as important, if not more, in getting our vision implemented and being a part of that vision.
Yeah, what do we say? That's enough about me. Why don't you tell me about me?
Right. That's exactly right. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to connect with you and learn more?
Oh, I have a website, paulgibbons.net. I have a book called The Science of Organizational Change. And I have two other little books. One's called Reboot Your Life, which is a sort of self-coaching, relaunch your life kind of book, and Reboot Your Career. But the big book is Science of Organizational Change. I mean, that's the one that I think I'm most proud of, if you want me to say. But Paul, give us on it. And also, I'm going to say this. I am launching a podcast tomorrow.
And it it'll have aired by the time this airs.
Oh, probably. Yeah. All right, then. Well, we'll see. We'll put a footnote in it.
Well, so I've just launched. We'll just change language.
It doesn't compete with anything that we've talked about today, because it's really going to be on – it's going to be on a lot of things. It's going to be on gluten. It's going to be on Bitcoin. It's going to be on politics. It's going to be on democracy. It's going to be on charter schools. It's going to be how do we make good decisions as individuals and citizens in a world – which is really, really complex, which is moving really, really quickly, and where the information that we get, we'll call it fake news or call it advertorials or call it manipulation of consumer opinion by businesses or whatever, the information we receive is so corrupted. But yet we have to make these calls in our lives. Should I vaccinate my children? You know, should I get an electric car? Like, we're making these calls all the time that are really important to us. And how do you do that? So that's my podcast. It's called Think Bigger, Think Better. And I'm going to be launching that on Friday, the 15th of December. So
excellent.
Perhaps this will air a little after that. Anyway, That's me. That's the pitch. What were you going to ask me? What's the last cool question?
Yeah. Before I ask you that, I was just going to say, we'll put all of that in the show notes. I'm super excited for your podcast. You had me a gluten. I don't know what the episode's going to be, but I'm intrigued. And I love this idea of how do we make decisions? I was just interviewing a gentleman, Zach, from the Drucker Institute, and we were talking about information obesity, how we just take in so much information, good, bad. It's just how do you even decide what to listen to make decisions? So thrilled for all of that. Can't wait to put it in there. I would definitely go buy Paul's book for those of you listening. What I appreciate about it, and part of the reason we wanted him on the podcast, was I'm a big fan of people who question the common narratives out there, because I think oftentimes to the whole start of our conversation, we buy into these myths about how things are supposed to be and they become the prevailing narrative, yet we don't really know why. We just buy into them. So I appreciate the questioning. My last question for you is, I've got a bunch of innovators inside organizations, entrepreneurs, but particularly for those inside organizations who agree, they're listening to this and they're going, yes, change is something we should always be dealing with. We should be talking more about it. It shouldn't be scary. But they work in organizations that have the more, I would say, traditional approach to change. What can they do to help shift the narrative in their companies?
So if they're, you want to call it far down the totem pole, right?
Yep.
So they're a soldier, if you will, to use a military metaphor. There you go. What can they do for whom? For themselves or for their organization? Or who's going to benefit from this?
Well, both. Think of it as, you know, there's a lot of people, let's call it management, right? So there are, I mean, there's foot soldiers in the sense that, you know, like these organizations are huge, but, you know, they've got a team, they've got some influence, but they're working within a system that sees change, in particular in the old fashioned way of this point in time, we go through this process, and they want to move the needle, I think for themselves, I think there's a bit of identity in there, but also for their organizations, because they know if they can get their organization to shift, that things will be better for everybody.
Yeah. One of the things that most managers do poorly, again, our world isn't really equipped, is the urgency paradigm in our world means that people don't spend enough time reflecting and thinking about the big picture. And so one of the things, I think you'll agree, the journeys from management to leader is longer and longer time horizons. Like when you get started in an organization, you're 22. You're just doing what people tell you, right?
Yeah.
So your horizon is like, what do I got to do in the next 15 minutes?
Well, and everything's right? new. You're trying to kind of like, you're just learning.
Yeah. You're being told what to do, basically. I mean, you're not.
Yeah. It's all about the deadline that you've been asked to get to.
And then if you're a manager, you've got to coordinate a bunch of these people and you've got to take a slightly longer horizon. So I'm going to put this group of people together to create this value. But a lot of the value that you're creating is value that you've been told to create as a manager, right? Mm, somebody says it's a good idea.
Yeah,
right.
That's fair.
As you move to leader, you got to like lift your sights to the horizon and you've got to think about what's the 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10 year, 25 year term. And one of the reasons we admire Elon Musk so much, you know, most of us admire him and something like that, is he's thinking about 2050.
Yeah.
He's not thinking about...
He's like thinking past our lifetime.
And so people do that. So they say, okay, how do I do that, Paul? I'm busy. You know, I got the kids. I got soccer practice. You know, I got to take the car in to get it fixed. I got my manager's breathing down my neck. I've got the initiatives coming out my backside. I don't know whether I'm coming or going most days. How do I make the time? And the most high leverage thing that people can do is to circle some time. And, you know, I say this, it sounds obvious, but most people don't do it. Half an hour a week to use some kind of time management tool. It could be Stephen Covey, it could be David Allen, it could be whatever it is, and think about the coming 2 weeks and plan to use your time strategically, because you have two times 168 hours, which is 336 hours, if I'm not right. If you spend a half an hour trying to think about how am I going to get the most from these, thinking strategically about your life and your working life. And then do that on a quarterly and a yearly basis too, like Bill Gates, right? Like he was a busy dude when he ran Microsoft, right? You know, it's a big company.
But Mike, he had some things to do.
He had some things to do, right? It's not as if like he had like days and days in his calendar, you know, like he was trying to fill, right? So he used to take a week called Think Week for reflection, where he used to shut off all of the incoming electronic stuff, but he used to take, you know, stacks and stacks of books and papers. And he used to take Think Week just to think about the future, just to think about the next decade, just to think about the next 5 years. So it's a practice, it's a habit that people need to go from manager to leader, but to also for your own well-being, for your own time management, for your own personal effectiveness, for your own sense of control and autonomy in your life. Those sorts of reflective pauses. And a half an hour a week, you know, even 15 minutes would be better than most people do, to really think about how you use your time strategically. And again, use David Allen or use Stephen Covey or use someone else on time management. I don't care. But do something like that, I think, is the highest leverage thing you can do for yourself and your organization. So that's my shtick.
That is great advice. Paul, thank you so much for coming by Launch Street. This has been just incredibly insightful. I love these interviews. I've taken copious notes. I have things to do now. So in fact, I have reflective time to carve out is really what I have. So thank you.
You've got great energy. You've got a fabulous, fabulous offering. You know, your website is really world-class. So if everything you do in your life is as world-class as your website, you know, you're a pretty special offer there. Cool.
Before you go, what did you think? Let us know in the comments section on our website. I couldn't agree more that we need to question everything. It's no surprise, right? We need to ask what I call inciting questions. That's not the questions we've always asked, because that gets us to the same answers and to the same place. But to ask the questions we've never asked, that we dare ask, that stir and prompt new thinking. In fact, we have an entire micro lesson on just that, asking inciting questions, and one on asking disruptive questions on our on-demand innovation library and courses. So if you're interested in being the one that stirs the innovation pot, then go to our website and get your access at gotolaunchstreet.com and click on on-demand. I'll leave you with this question, Launchstreeters. What would happen if you asked your team to throw out everything that worked yesterday and come up with new things that'll work tomorrow? Try it. You will stir something up for sure. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on gotolaunchstreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. Go to launchstreet.com.